Section 12 of The Diary of a Provincial Lady by E. M. Delafield. This Lagamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. September 1st. Postcard from the station announces arrival of parcel that I at once identify as bulbs, with accompanying fibre, moss, and charcoal mixture. Suggest that Robert should fetch them this afternoon, but he is unenthusiastic and says tomorrow, when he will be meeting Robin and school friend, will do quite well. Memo. Very marked difference between the sexes is male tendency to procrastinate doing practically everything in the world, except sitting down to meals and going up to bed. Should like to purchase little painted motto, "Do it now," so often on sale at inferior stationers' shops, and present it to Robert, but on second thoughts quite see that this would not conduce to domestic harmony, and abandon scheme at once. Think seriously about bulbs, and spread sheets of newspaper on attic floor to receive them and bowls. Resolve also to keep careful record of all operations, with eventual results, for future guidance. Look out a notebook for the purpose, and find small green booklet, with mysterious references, of which I can make neither head nor tail, in own handwriting on first two pages. Spend some time in trying to decide what I could have meant by KPP in SH twice, PW without fail, or tell H not 12 inches by 8 inches, washable FC to be G'd, but eventually give it up, and tear out first two pages of little green book, and write bulbs and tomorrow's date in capital letters. September 2nd. Robert brings home Robin and friend called Mickey Thompson from station, but has unfortunately forgotten to call for the bulbs. Mickey Thompson is attractive and shows enchanting dimple whenever he smiles, which is often. Memo. Theory that mothers think their own children superior to any others, absolute nonsense. Can see only too plainly that Mickey easily surpasses Robin and Vicky in looks, charm, and good manners, and am very much annoyed about it. September 4th. Mickey Thompson continues to show himself as charming child, with cheerful disposition, good manners, and excellent health. Inquiry reveals that he is an orphan, which does not surprise me in the least. Have often noticed that absence of parental solicitude usually very beneficial to offspring. Bulbs still at station. September 10th. Unbroken succession of picnics, bathing expeditions, and drives to Plymouth Cafe in search of ices. Mademoiselle continually predicts catastrophes to digestions, lungs, or even brains, but none materialize. September 11th. Departure of Mickey Thompson, but am less concerned with this than with Robert's return from station, this time accompanied by bulbs and half-bushel of fibre, moss, and charcoal. Devote entire afternoon to planting these, with much advice from Vicky and Robin, and enter full details of transaction in little green book. Prepare to carry all, with utmost care, into furthest and darkest recess of attic, when Vicky suddenly announces that Helen Wills is there already, with 6 brand-new kittens. Great excitement follows, which I am obliged to suggest had better be modified before Daddy inquires into its cause. Children agree to this, but feel very little confidence in their discretion. Am obliged to leave bulbs in secondary corner of attic, owing to humane scruples about disturbing H. Wills and family. September 20th. Letter from County Secretary of adjoining county, telling me that she knows how busy I am, which I'm certain she doesn't, but women's institutes of Chick, Littlemarch, and Crimpington find themselves in terrible difficulty owing to uncertainty about next month's speaker. Involved fragments about son coming, or not coming, home on leave from Patagonia, and daughter ill, but not dangerously, at Bromley, Kent, follow. President is away. Further fragment about President being obliged to visit aged relative, while aged relative's maid is on holiday, and County Secretary does not know what to do. What she does do, however, is to suggest that I should be prepared to come and speak at all three Institute meetings if, as she rather strangely puts it, the worst comes to the worst. Separate half-sheet of paper gives details about dates, times, and bus between Chick and Littlemarch, leading on to Doctor's Sister's two-seater, at crossroads between Littlemarch and Crimpington Hill. At Crimpington, County Secretary concludes triumphantly, I shall be put up for the night by Lady Magdalene Crimp, always so kind and such a friend to the movement, at Crimpington Hall. P.S. Travel talks always popular, but anything I like will be delightful. Chick very keen about folklore, Littlemarch more on the handicraft side. But anything I like. P.P.S. Would I be so kind as to judge recitation competition at Crimpington? I think this over for some time, and decide to write and say that I will do it, as Robin will have returned to school next week, and should like to distract my mind. Tell Mademoiselle casually that I may be going on a short tour, speaking, and she is suitably impressed. Vicky inquires, like a menagerie, Mummy? Which seems to me very extraordinary simile, though innocently meant. I reply, no, not in the least like a menagerie, and Mademoiselle adds, officiously, more like a mission. Am by no means at one with her here, but have no time to go further into the subject, as Gladys summons me to prolonged discussion with the laundry, represented by man in white coat at the back gate, concerning cotton sheet, said to be one of a pair, but which has been returned in solitary widowhood. The laundry has much to say about this, and presently cook, gardener, Mademoiselle, Vicky, and unidentified boy, apparently attached to laundry, have all gathered round. Everyone except Boy supports Gladys by saying, "That's right," to everything she asserts, and I eventually leave them to it. Evidently all takes time, as it is not till 40 minutes later that I see Gardiner slowly returning to his work, and hear Van driving away. Go up to attic and inspect bulb bowls, but nothing to be seen. Cannot decide whether they require water or not, but think perhaps better be on the safe side, so give them some. Make note in little green book to this effect, as am determined to keep full record of entire procedure. September 22nd. Invitation from Lady B. Note delivered by hand, wait reply, to Robert and myself to come and dine tonight. Reads more like a royal command, and no suggestion that short notice may be inconvenient. Robert out, and I act with promptitude and firmness on own responsibility, and reply that we are already engaged for dinner. Query. Will this suggest convivial evening at neighbouring rectory, or rissoles and cocoa with old Mrs. Blenkinsop and Cousin Maud? Can conceive of no other alternatives. Telephone rings in a peremptory manner, just as I am reading aloud enchanting book The Exciting Family by M.D. Hilliard, surely occasional contributor to Time and Tide, and I rush to dining-room to deal with it. Note. Must really overcome foolish and immature tendency to feel that any telephone call may be prelude to A. announcement of a fortune, or, alternatively, B. news of immense and impressive calamity. On snatching up receiver, unmistakable tones of Lady B. are heard, at once suggesting perhaps rather ill-natured, but not unjustifiable, comparison with a peahen. What, she inquires, is all this nonsense? Of course we must dine tonight. She won't hear of a refusal. Besides, what else can we possibly be doing, unless it's meetings, and if so we can cut them for once? Am at once invaded by host of improbable inspirations. For example, that the Lord Lieutenant of the county and his wife are dining here informally, or that Rose's Viscountess is staying with us, and refuses either to be left alone, or to be taken to Lady B's, which I know she would at once suggest. Or even that, really, Robert and I have had so many late nights recently, that we cannot face another one. But do not go so far as to proffer any of them aloud. am disgusted, instead, to hear myself saying weakly that Robin goes back to school day after tomorrow, and we do not like to go out on one of his last few evenings at home. This may be true so far as I am concerned, but can imagine no suggestion less likely to be endorsed by Robert, and trust that he may never come to hear of it. In any case, it instantly revives long-standing determination of Lady B's to establish me with reputation for being a perfect mother, and she at once takes advantage of it. I return to the exciting family in a state of great inward fury. September 24th. Frightful welter of packing, putting away, and earnest consultations of school list. Robin gives everybody serious injunctions about not touching anything whatever in his bedroom, which looks like inferior pawnbroking establishment at stock-taking time, and we all more or less commit ourselves to leaving it alone till Christmas holidays, which is completely out of the question. He is taken away by Robert in the car, looking forlorn and infantile, and Vicky roars. I beseech her to desist at once, but am rebuked by Mademoiselle, who says, "Ah, elle a tant de cœur," in tone which implies that she cannot say as much for myself. October 1st. Tell Robert about proposed short tour to Chick, Little March and Crimpington, on behalf of W.I.'s. He says little, but that little not very enthusiastic. I spend many hours, or so it seems, looking out notes for talks, and trying to remember anecdotes that shall be at once funny and suitable. This combination rather unusual. Pack small bag, search frantically all over writing table, bedroom and drawing room for W.I. badge, which is at last discovered by Mademoiselle in remote corner of drawer devoted to stockings, and take my departure. Robert drives me to station, and I beg that he will keep an eye on the bulbs whilst I am away. October 2nd. Bus from Chick conveys me to Littlemarch, after successful meeting last night, at which I discourse on amateur theatricals, am applauded, thanked by President in the chair, name inaudible, applauded once more, and taken home by Assistant Secretary, who is putting me up for the night. We talk about the movement. Annual meeting at Blackpool, perhaps a mistake, why not Bristol or Plymouth? Difficulty of thinking out new programmes for monthly meetings, and really magnificent performance of Chick at recent folk-dancing rally, at which Institute members called upon to go through Gathering Peas Cods no less than 3 times. Two of Chick's best performers, says Assistant Secretary proudly, being grandmothers. I express astonished admiration, and we go on to village halls, Sir Oswald Mosley, and methods of removing ink stains from linen. Just as Assistant Secretary, who is unmarried and lives in nice little cottage, has escorted me to charming little bedroom, she remembers that I am eventually going on to Crimpington, and embarks on interesting scandal about 2 members of Institute there, and unaccountable disappearance of 1 member's name from committee. This keeps us up until 11 o'clock, when she begs me to say nothing whatever about her having mentioned the affair, which was all told her in strictest confidence, and we part. Reach Littlemarch, via the bus, which is old and rattles, in time for lunch. Doctor's sister meets me, elderly lady with dog, and talks about hunting. Meeting takes place at 3 o'clock, in a delightful hut, and am impressed by business-like and efficient atmosphere. Doctor's sister, in the chair, introduces me. Unluckily my name eludes her at 11th hour, but I hastily supply it, and she says, "Of course, of course," and I launch out into a visit to Switzerland. As soon as I have finished, elderly member surges up from front row and says that this has been particularly interesting to her, as she once lived in Switzerland for nearly 14 years, and knows every inch of it from end to end. My own experience confined to 6 weeks, round and about Lucerne, 10 years ago. We drink cups of tea, eat excellent buns, sing several community songs, and meeting comes to an end. Doctor's sister's two-seater, now altogether homelike, receives me once again, and I congratulate her on Institute. She smiles and talks about hunting. Evening passes off quietly. Doctor comes in, elderly man with two dogs. He also talks about hunting, and we all separate for bed at 10 o'clock. October 3rd. Part early from doctor, sister, dogs, and two-seater, and proceed by train to Crimpington, as meeting does not take place till afternoon, and have no wish to arrive earlier than I need. Curious cross-country journey with many stops, and one change, involving long and draughty wait, that I enliven by a cup of Bovril. Superb car meets me, with superb chauffeur, who despises me and my bag at sight, but is obliged to drive us both to Crimpington Hall. Butler receives me, and I am conducted through immense and chilly hall with stone flags, to equally immense and chilly drawing-room, where he leaves me. Very small fire is lurking behind steel bars at far end of room, and I make my way to it past little gilt tables, large chairs and sofas, cabinets apparently lined with china cups and lustre teapots, and massive writing-tables entirely furnished with hundreds of photographs in silver frames. Butler suddenly reappears with the Times, which he hands to me on small salver. Have already read it from end to end in the train, but feel obliged to open it and begin all over again. He looks doubtfully at the fire, and I hope he is going to put on more coal, but instead he goes away, and is presently replaced by Lady Magdalen Crimp, who is about 95 and stone-deaf. She wears black and large fur cape, as well she may. She produces trumpet, and I talk down it, and she smiles and nods, and has evidently not heard one word, which is just as well as none of them worth hearing. After some time she suggests my room, and we creep along slowly for about quarter of a mile, till first floor is reached, and vast bedroom with old-fashioned four-poster in the middle of it. Here she leaves me, and I wash from little brass jug of tepid water, and note, by no means for the first time, that the use of powder, when temperature has sunk below a certain level, merely casts extraordinary azure shade over nose and chin. Faint hope of finding fire in dining-room is extinguished on entering it, when I am at once struck by its resemblance to a mausoleum. Lady M. and I sit down at mahogany circular table. She says, "Do I mind a cold lunch?" I shake my head, as being preferable to screaming "No" down trumpet, though equally far from the truth, and we eat rabbit cream, coffee-shape, and Marie biscuits. Conversation spasmodic and unsatisfactory, and I am reduced to looking at portraits on wall of gentlemen in wigs and ladies with bosoms, also objectionable study of dead bird, dripping blood, lying amongst oranges and other vegetable matter. Should like to know what dear Rose, with her appreciation of art, would say to this. Later we adjourn to drawing-room, fire now a mere ember, and Lady M. explains that she is not going to the meeting, but vice-president will look after me, and she hopes I shall enjoy recitation competition. Some of our members really very clever, and one, in particular, so amusing in dialect. I nod and smile, and continue to shiver, and presently car fetches me away to village. Meeting is held in reading-room, which seems to me perfect paradise of warmth, and I place myself as close as possible to large oil-stove. Vice-president, very large and expansive in blue, conducts everything successfully, and I deliver homily about what our children read, which is kindly received. After tea, delightfully hot, in fact scalds me, but I welcome it, recitation competition takes place, and have to rivet my attention on successive members, who mount a little platform and declaim in turns. We begin with not very successful rendering of verses hitherto unknown to me, entitled Our Institute, and which turn out to be original composition of reciter. This followed by Gunga Din, and very rousing poem about keeping the old flag flying. elderly member then announces the mine, and is very dramatic and impressive, but not wholly intelligible, which I put down to dialect. Finally, award first place to the old flag, and second to the mine, and present prizes. Am unfortunately inspired to observe that dialect poems are always so interesting, and it then turns out that the mine wasn't in dialect at all. However, too late to do anything about it. Meeting is prolonged, for which I am thankful, but finally can no longer defer returning to Arctic regions of Crimpington Hall. Lady M. and I spend evening cowering over grate, and exchanging isolated remarks, and many nods and smiles across ear-trumpet. Finally I get into enormous four-poster, covered by very inadequate supply of blankets, and clutching insufficiently heated hot water bottle. October 5th. Develop really severe cold 24 hours after reaching home. Robert says that all institutes are probably full of germs, which is both unjust and ridiculous. October 13th. Continued cold and cough keep me in house, and make me unpopular with Robert, Cook, and Gladys, the latter of whom both catch my complaint. Mademoiselle keeps Vicky away, but is sympathetic, and brings Vicky to gesticulate dramatically at me from outside the drawing-room window, as though I had the plague. Gradually this state of affairs subsides, my daily quota of pocket handkerchiefs returns to the normal, and vapex, cinnamon, camphorated oil, and jar of cold cream all go back to medicine cupboard in bathroom once more. Unknown benefactor sends me copy of New Literary Review, which seems to be full of personal remarks from well-known writers about other well-known writers. This perhaps more amusing to themselves than to average reader. Moreover, competition's most alarmingly literary, and I return with immense relief to old friend Time and Tide. October 17th. Surprising invitation to evening party. Dancing, 9:30, at Lady B's. Cannot possibly refuse, as Robert has been told to make himself useful there in various ways. Moreover, entire neighbourhood is evidently being polished off, and see no object in raising question as to whether we have or have not received invitation. Decide to get new dress, but must have it made locally, owing to rather sharply worded inquiry from London shop, which has the privilege of serving me, as to whether I have not overlooked overdue portion of account. Far from overlooking it, have actually been kept awake by it at night. Proceed to Plymouth, and get very attractive black taffeta, with little pink and blue posies scattered over it. Mademoiselle removes and washes Honiton lace from old purple velvet every-night tea-gown, and assures me that it will be gentille croquet on new taffeta. Also buy new pair black evening shoes, but shall wear them every evening for at least an hour, in order to ensure reasonable comfort at party. Am able to congratulate myself that great-aunt's diamond ring, for once, is at home when needed. Robert rather shatteringly remarks that he believes the dancing is only for the young people, and I heatedly inquire how line of demarcation is to be laid down. Should certainly not dream of accepting ruling from Lady B on any such delicate question. Robert merely repeats that only the young will be expected to dance, and we drop the subject, and I inquire into nature of refreshments to be expected at party, as 9:30 seems to me singularly inhospitable hour, involving no regular meal whatever. Robert begs that I will order dinner at home exactly as usual, and make it as substantial as possible, so as to give him every chance of keeping awake at party, and I agree that this would indeed appear desirable. October 9th. Rumour that Lady B's party is to be in fancy dress throws entire neighbourhood into consternation. Our vicar's wife comes down on gardener's wife's bicycle, borrowed, she says, for greater speed and urgency, and explains that, in her position, she does not think that fancy dress would do at all, unless perhaps poudre, which she asserts is different, but takes ages to brush out afterwards. She asks what I am going to do, but am quite unable to enlighten her, as black taffeta already completed. Mademoiselle, at this, intervenes, and declares that black taffeta can be transformed by a touch into Dresden China shepherdess, a ravir. I'm obliged to beg her not to be ridiculous, nor attempt to make me so, and then she insanely suggests turning black taffeta into costume for A. Mary Queen of Scots, B. Madame de Pompadour, C. Cleopatra. I desire her to take Vicky for a walk. She is blessée, and much time is spent in restoring her to calm. Our vicar's wife, who has meantime been walking up and down drawing-room in state of stress and agitation, says, "What about asking somebody else? What about the Kelways? Why not ring them up?" We immediately do so, and are light-heartedly told by Mary Kelway that it is fancy dress, and she is going to wear her Russian peasant costume, absolutely genuine, brought by sailor cousin from Moscow long years ago. But if in difficulties, can she lend me anything? Reply incoherently to this kind offer, as our vicar's wife, now in uncontrollable agitation, makes it impossible for me to collect my thoughts. Chaos prevails when Robert enters, is frenziedly appealed to by our vicar's wife, and says, "Oh, didn't he say so? One or two people have had fancy dress put on invitation cards, as Lady B's own house-party intends to dress up, but no such suggestion has been made to majority of guests." Our vicar's wife and I agree at some length that, really, nobody in this world but Lady B would behave like this, and we have very good minds not to go near her party. Robert and I then arrange to take our vicar and his wife with us in car to party. She is grateful and goes. October 23rd. Party takes place. Black taffeta and Honiton lace look charming, and I'm not dissatisfied with general appearance, after extracting two quite unmistakable grey hairs. Vicky goes so far as to say that I look lovely, but inquires shortly afterwards why old people so often wear black, which discourages me. Received by Lady B in magnificent Eastern costume, with pearls dripping all over her, and surrounded by bevy of equally bejewelled friends. She smiles graciously and shakes hands without looking at any of us, and strange fancy crosses my mind that it would be agreeable to bestow on her sudden sharp shaking, and thus compel her to recognise existence of at least one of guests invited to her house. Am obliged, however, to curb this unhallowed impulse, and proceed quietly into vast drawing-room, at one end of which band is performing briskly on platform. Our vicar's wife, Violet Net and Garnets, recognises friends, and takes our vicar away to speak to them. Robert is imperatively summoned by Lady B. Is she going to order him to take charge of cloakroom or what? And I am greeted by an unpleasant-looking Hamlet, who suddenly turns out to be Miss Pankerton. "Why," she asks accusingly, "am I not in fancy dress? It would do me all the good in the world to give myself over to the carnival spirit. It is what I need." I make inquiry for Jasper. Should never be surprised to hear that he has come as Ophelia. But Miss P. replies that Jasper is in Bloomsbury again. Bloomsbury can do nothing without Jasper. I say, no, I suppose not, in order to avoid hearing any more about either Jasper or Bloomsbury, and talk to Mary Kelway, who looks nice in Russian peasant costume, and eventually dance with her husband. We see many of our neighbours, most of them not in fancy dress, and I'm astounded at unexpected sight of Blenkinsop's cousin Maud, bounding round the room with short stout partner, identified by Mary's husband as Great Hunting Man. Lady B's house-party, all in expensive disguises and looking highly superior, dance languidly with one another, and no introductions take place. It later becomes part of Robert's duty to tell everyone that supper is ready, and we all flock to buffet in dining-room, and are given excellent sandwiches and unidentified form of cup. Lady B's expensive-looking house-party nowhere to be seen, and Robert tells me in gloomy aside that he thinks they are in the library having champagne. I express charitable and improbable hope that it may poison them, to which Robert merely replies, hush, not so loud, but should not be surprised to know that he agrees with me. Final and most unexpected incident of the evening is when I come upon old Miss Blenkinsop, all over black jet and wearing martyred expression, sitting in large armchair underneath platform and exactly below energetic saxophone. She evidently has not the least idea how to account for her presence there, and saxophone prevents conversation, but can distinguish something about Maud and not getting between young things and their pleasure, and reference to old Mrs. B. not having very much longer to spend amongst us. I smile and nod my head, then feel that this may look unsympathetic, so frown and shake it, and am invited to dance by male Frobisher, who talks about old furniture and birds. House party reappear, carrying balloons, which they distribute like buns at a school feast, and party proceeds until midnight. Band then bursts into Auld Lang Syne, and Lady B screams, "Come along, come along!" and all are directed to form a circle. Singular melee ensues, and I see old Mrs. Blenkinsop swept from armchair, and clutching our vicar with one hand, and unknown young gentleman with the other. Our vicar's wife is holding hands with Miss Pankerton, whom she cannot endure, and looks distraught, and Robert is seized upon by massive stranger in scarlet, and Cousin Maud. Am horrified to realise that I am myself, on one side clasping hand of particularly offensive young male specimen of house party, and on the other that of Lady B. We all shuffle round to well-known strains, and sing for Auld Lang Syne, for Auld Lang Syne, over and over again, since no one appears to know any other words, and relief is general when this exercise is brought to a close. Lady B, evidently fearing that we shall none of us know when she has had enough of us, then directs band to play National Anthem, which is done, and she receives our thanks and farewells. Go home, and on looking at myself in the glass, am much struck with undeniable fact that at the end of a party I do not look nearly as nice as I did at the beginning. Should like to think that this applies to every woman, but am not sure, and anyway, this thought ungenerous, like so many others. Robert says, "Why don't I get into bed?" I say, "Because I am writing my diary." Robert replies, kindly but quite definitely, that, in his opinion, that is waste of time. I get into bed, and am confronted by, query, can Robert be right? Can only leave reply to posterity. End of The Diary of a Provincial Lady by E. M. Delafield, read by Corrie Samuel. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit legamus.eu.